So I want you to look back at the last time you completely ruined a meal.
Oh no.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it was a blackened chicken or like a pot of rice that somehow just fused at a molecular level with the bottom of your favorite saucepan.
We have all been there. It is the absolute worst feeling.
Right. Did you feel that familiar wave of domestic shame? Well, what if I told you that a ruined dinner isn't actually a sign of incompetence?
Which is such a wild concept to wrap your head around.
It really is.
Wow.
Because what if, instead, it's actually the mark of a highly intelligent, deeply curious mind?
I mean, it's a completely different way of looking at a totally universal problem. Like, we usually treat burning dinner as this huge failure, you know, something to just quickly scrape into the trash before anyone sees it.
Exactly. Hide the evidence.
Right. But today, we're flipping that entire assumption on its head.
We absolutely are. So, welcome to today's deep dive. We are looking into a wonderfully unconventional book. It's called Court Noir, A Survival Guide for Distracted Cooks.
Such a great title.
It is. It's written by Penny Moon, and it features these incredibly charming illustrations by Paul Warren. But I want to make it clear up front, this isn't just a
You
cookbook
know, none of
or like a list of kitchen hacks.
Yeah.
It's really this fascinating exploration of how our brains work, you know, where our attention goes, and why we really shouldn't feel so guilty when our minds just wander off.
And Mania Moon is honestly the perfect guide for this because she hasn't just theorized about culinary disaster, she has lived it.
Or she definitely has.
Yeah, she's famously set off smoke alarms on three separate continents.
Wait, it was England, France, and China, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
England, France, and China. So she's bringing this deeply human, very relatable philosophy to the table. She argues that you don't burn food because you're a bad cook. You burn food because you are simply too interested in life to just, you know, stand around watching a stove.
I love that. And I really love how she frames this right from the start by taking a pretty big swing at modern food culture.
Oh, she does not hold back.
No. She contrasts her whole philosophy with things like nouvelle cuisine, you know, those tiny, precious portions that are arranged with tweezers like some sort of art
Where are the
installation.
molecular gastronomy stuff?
Yes, where you're eating like edible foams and spherified juices, and the whole thing feels way more like a chemistry exam than an actual meal.
Right, because those high-end culinary movements, they're all about meticulous control. It's all about elevating presentation and precision above literally everything else.
Yeah.
But Moon argues that the Cour de Noir tradition, which is just regular people who accidentally carbonize their dinner, is infinitely more common. And honestly, a lot more authentic to the human experience.
She actually suggests that if you're burning your dinner, it means you have a quote, rich inner life.
Which is such a great compliment to give yourself when the kitchen is full of smoke.
Right. Like
You
your
got
mind
me.
is just capable of traveling to places that are far more interesting than the inside of a frying pan.
Let's actually look at the psychology there for a second, because I think it's brilliant. Society basically dictates that a successful evening means serving a perfectly timed roast.
Sure.
But Moon asks us to redefine success. Like, maybe a successful evening is realizing you just spent 45 minutes deeply absorbed in a really complex thought.
Or watching a beautiful sunset.
Exactly, even if it cost you the roast,
Yeah.
because you're losing track of the food because you are intensely present to the world around you.
And she gives these incredibly specific, relatable examples in the book. And they're captured beautifully in Paul Warren's illustrations, by the way. Like, you get distracted by a sudden unbidden insight about your career, or maybe a memory, or, and this is my personal favorite, you get completely absorbed watching a seagull stamp for worms in the rain outside your kitchen window.
Oh, that seagull image is just so evocative. And there's actually a biological reason you'd find that captivating.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Seagulls stamp their feet to mimic the vibration of rain, which tricks the worms into coming to the surface.
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
Yeah, it's this amazing piece of evolutionary problem solving. So, if you are standing at your window observing that, your brain is engaged in high-level curiosity and pattern recognition.
That makes so much sense.
Right. It is a deeply enriching cognitive state. Now, compare that to the cognitive state of watching water boil.
Right, there's no contest.
Exactly. It is no wonder your brain chooses the seagull.
Okay, I hear that, but I feel like I have to play devil's advocate for just a second here.
Go for it.
Because pretty much every self-help guru, lifestyle blog, and wellness influencer out there is constantly beating the drum of mindfulness,
Oh,
right?
definitely. It's everywhere.
We are constantly told we need to practice mindfulness in the kitchen, focus on the task at hand, feel the texture of the vegetables as we chop them, all of that. So how does Moon reconcile this whole defense of distraction with this massive cultural push to be present while cooking?
It's a great question, and it's actually the crucial tension at the heart of her book. And the thing is, she doesn't reject mindfulness at all.
Oh, she doesn't.
No, she just challenges our really narrow definition of it. Because the wellness industry often treats mindfulness as this exercise in forced concentration. Like forcing your brain to care about chopping carrots when it desperately wants to think about something else.
Oh, that's a really good point.
Moon argues that you definitely should be present, but you should be present to what actually matters to you.
So if my mind naturally drifts away from the potatoes because I find myself in this deep philosophical debate with my spouse, or I'm suddenly untangling a complex problem from work, she's saying that is my mindfulness.
Precisely. In cognitive psychology, we talk about directed attention versus spontaneous thought.
Okay.
Forced mindfulness, like staring at a carrot, requires exhausting amounts of directed attention. But when your mind wanders to a fascinating memory or a debate about the nature of reality, you're entering a state of flow or open awareness.
Oh.
You are practicing mindfulness. You're just directing it at something your brain finds genuinely stimulating.
I mean, that is just a massive relief for anyone standing in a smoke-filled kitchen.
Yeah.
You aren't failing at mindfulness. You're just pointing it at a better target.
Exactly.
But let's be pragmatic for a second here. Because philosophy won't unburn the roast.
Unfortunately, no.
If your brain is naturally hardwired to drift away toward the fascinating things in life, how do you physically prevent your house from catching fire? Because, you know, dinner guests do still expect recognizable food.
Right. Smoke alarms do not care about your rich inner life.
They really don't.
You have to implement mechanical safeguards to protect against your own psychology.
Which is where her survival tactics come in.
Yeah.
And I love this part. Her most critical strategy revolves around timers.
Yes, the timers.
But not just setting a timer on your microwave. She says the single most important tool for the distracted cook is multiple timers set at staggered intervals.
The staggered interval is the real key here to breaking a flow state. Think about what happens when you're deeply engrossed in a book or like a daydream. A single beep from a kitchen timer in the other room is just so easily integrated into whatever you're thinking about.
Oh, absolutely.
Your brain just incorporates the noise and completely ignores the urgency.
I totally do that with my morning alarm. Like if it just beeps once, it just becomes part of my dream.
Right. So Moon says one timer is easily ignored. Two timers create a sort of vague sense of urgency.
Okay.
But three timers, staggered a few minutes apart and physically scattered around the house like breadcrumbs, that makes it nearly impossible to ignore reality.
It's basically an auditory assault designed to shatter your cognitive absorption.
Exactly. You have one on your phone in your pocket, a really loud one on the oven, and maybe an obnoxious wind-up timer sitting on the dining table.
So you have to actually get up.
Right. It forces you to physically move through your environment to turn them off, which breaks the trance and physically brings you back to the stove.
And speaking of the physical environment, she also has a lot to say about the tools and appliances that are secretly on your side. Like, she calls the slow cooker a, quote, patient and long-suffering friend.
The slow cooker was essentially engineered for the wandering mind. It really is a thermodynamic safety net.
She jokes that you can throw ingredients into a slow cooker in the morning, wander off to contemplate the nature of consciousness, have a 3-hour debate about Robin Hood.
As one does.
Right. Take a walk to observe those flamenco seagulls stamping in the yard. And when you finally remember dinner, it isn't just cooked. It's actually improved by your neglect. She calls it alchemy.
And scientifically speaking, she's actually right. It is a kind of alchemy. It's specifically the breakdown of tough connective tissues and the slow development of flavor compounds.
Which just takes time.
Exactly. It requires time, not attention. And this ties directly into her strategy for curating a menu. If you know you're prone to distraction, you have to choose culinary friends, not enemies.
Let me guess. Friends are the things that thrive on being ignored.
You got it. Things like caramelized onions, braised short ribs, slow roasted tomatoes. These rely on low ambient heat. The Maillard reaction, which is that browning process that creates complex flavors, it happens beautifully when you just leave things alone on a low temperature.
But then there are the enemies. And, I mean, I have to say this with the dramatic weight it deserves. Risotto is not your friend.
Oh, absolutely not.
Soufflés are your enemy.
Yes. Anything that demands constant thermal monitoring or continuous physical agitation, like standing there stirring risotto for 20 minutes, is a trap.
A total trap.
The stovetop in general is highly volatile compared to the oven. The oven burns things much more slowly, which buys you a precious, say, 10-minute window of reverie.
Right.
But even then, Moon warns you have to pair the oven with the multiple timer strategy, or else you don't save the food, you just achieve a much more thorough carbonization.
That makes perfect sense. Okay, so this brings me to my absolute favorite tip in the entire book. It's her visible reminder method, or as I like to call it, the rubber duck technique.
Oh, this is brilliant.
It is. Moon suggests placing something totally absurd in your line of sight to remind you that you're cooking. So not a post-it note, but an actual rubber duck, or like a tiny statue of a unicorn sitting right on the kitchen counter, or even a framed photo of yourself looking stern and pointing at the stove.
This is a phenomenal real-world application of cognitive science. It's specifically about how we combat habituation.
Habituation.
Yeah. Our brains are ultimately efficiency engines. To save energy, they literally stop processing visual information that they expect to see.
Oh, like driving home on a familiar route and suddenly realizing you don't remember the last 5 miles? Like highway hypnosis.
Exactly. That's sensory adaptation. When you're in your kitchen, your brain expects to see spatulas, spice racks, cutting boards, so it filters them out. They just become invisible background noise.
Right.
If your mind is wandering, a spatula isn't going to pull you back to reality because it belongs there.
But a rubber duck sitting next to the olive oil? That does not belong there.
Right. In neuroscience, that's called a prediction error. Your brain is constantly predicting its environment. When it encounters an anomaly, like a bright yellow bath toy next to the stove, it forces your visual cortex to spend energy processing it.
It wakes you up.
Yeah. The brain essentially stutters, stops the daydream, and asks, why is there a duck here?
And then the dominoes fall. Like, why is there a duck? Oh, because I put it there. Why did I put it there? Oh, no, the potatoes.
Exactly.
It's this deliberate glitch you plant in your own matrix to yank yourself back to the present. I just absolutely love that.
It's highly effective. But as Moon is really quick to admit, even with a trail of staggered timers and a flock of rubber ducks guarding the stovetop, things will inevitably go wrong.
Right. Which forces us to talk about damage control.
The inevitable.
What is the protocol when the potatoes have finally, tragically achieved full carbonization?
Well, the first line of defense, assuming you don't live alone, is the buddy system. You explicitly go to your partner or roommate and say, I am cooking. Please remind me in 20 minutes that I am cooking because I will forget.
But she includes this very funny, highly realistic caveat to this.
Mm-hmm.
She says, this works about 60% of the time.
Right. And the other 40% of the time, the buddy also forgets.
Yes. So you both just end up standing there, staring at the smoke, united in your collective absent-mindedness.
It's a bonding moment.
It really is. But why does that happen? Because I've definitely done this with my partner. I'll ask them to keep an ear out for the oven, and we both end up getting completely distracted by a movie or something.
So that 40% failure rate is actually a classic psychological phenomenon. It's known as the diffusion of responsibility.
Oh, interesting.
It's really similar to the bystander effect. When you are the only one cooking, 100% of the responsibility is on your shoulders. But the moment you deputize a roommate, your brain offloads a significant portion of that cognitive weight. You relax your vigilance because you just assume they are monitoring the situation.
And they assume I'm still monitoring it because, well, I'm the one making dinner. So literally nobody is watching the stove.
Exactly.
It's like being on a group project at work.
Yeah.
Where everyone just assumes someone else is taking notes.
Precisely. You diffuse the responsibility so thinly that it just evaporates entirely.
So when the buddy system fails and the food is undeniably burnt, Moon offers some emergency public relations advice.
Which is very necessary.
Very. First, just keep your windows open. If the kitchen is well ventilated, the smoke alarm is less likely to go off, which means your neighbors won't call the fire department.
Always a plus. And if the alarm does go off, she advises taking a towel and vigorously fanning the smoke alarm, which, you know, looks entirely ridiculous, but it physically clears the particulate matter from the sensor.
And if anyone asks what the noise is, you just confidently claim you are performing a routine test of the alarm system.
It's all about the spin.
It's all about the spin. If the food is only mildly singed, you don't apologize. You rebrand it.
You call it rustic.
Yes. You say it's intentionally charred for flavor.
I mean, it sounds much more sophisticated than admitting you got distracted by a podcast.
Way more sophisticated.
But the PR spin only goes so far. Like, what happens when the main course is just fundamentally destroyed and guests are arriving in 10 minutes?
Her advice here is brutally pragmatic.
Yeah.
You order takeaway, You quickly transfer it onto your nice dinner plates, and then, and I quote, you never speak of what happened.
I love that.
She reasons that your guests will either be charmed by your chaotic honesty if they happen to catch you, or they'll just be too polite to mention that the homemade lasagna tastes exactly like the Italian place down the street.
Either way, you survive the evening.
Exactly. And this leads to a really important structural rule she has, the backup meal. Moon insists that a Cordon Noir practitioner must always, always have a 5-minute backup meal in the pantry.
Yes, this is crucial.
Like eggs, cheese, some good bread, just something you can assemble instantly when the primary dinner is beyond salvation.
Because I think a lot of people feel a deep sense of shame when they have to scrap a recipe and make scrambled eggs instead. They view it as a personal defeat.
Golden.
But Moon specifically reframes this. She says having eggs on standby isn't admitting defeat. It is strategic planning.
I love that shift in perspective.
That reframing is so vital because it acts as a pressure valve for culinary perfectionism.
Yeah.
It just removes the guilt. She tells her readers to make peace with imperfection. Sometimes, despite the timers, the ducks, and the buddy system, the vegetables are going to end up with a texture previously unknown to science.
Uncharted territory.
Right. You just scrape off the worst bits and serve it anyway.
And if you're in a real slump, she writes, and I love this line, if you have burned the same meal 3 times in a row, it is time to embrace the slow cooker. Or possibly time to accept that you should just eat more sandwiches.
There is zero shame in knowing your limits.
None at all. Though, she does add one rather extreme legal disclaimer. She says, if you have actually set the kitchen on fire, use the extinguisher, call the fire brigade, and consider it a sign from the universe that you should permanently transition to ordering pizza.
Which is just good life advice. But that humor really helps strip away the anxiety that makes cooking so stressful for so many of us.
It really does.
It's a radical acceptance of who you are. Which brings us to the final, and I think the most profound takeaway from the book. After all the jokes about smoke alarms and fanning towels, Moon gets to her final rule.
Yeah, it's really the emotional core of the entire Cordon Noir philosophy. She says, when you are standing in your kitchen staring at a ruined pan, feeling foolish and frustrated, and wondering why you can't just be normal, you must stop and remember why you forgot.
That is so powerful.
You forgot because you were watching that seagull, and it was beautiful.
Yeah.
You forgot because you were deep in a conversation that challenged your perspective, and that was important. You forgot because you were fully, completely present to the world around you, and that is a rare gift.
If we pull all these threads together, that is the ultimate lesson here. The burnt dinner can be replaced. You can always make more eggs or order a pizza. But that moment of pure connection, of deep thought, of unselfconscious observation, that moment cannot be replaced.
No, it couldn't.
You might sacrifice a meal in the process, but what you earn is something far more valuable. It's a life that is actually being lived, not just managed.
It's just a gorgeous way to forgive ourselves for our daily slip-ups. Mm-hmm. And there was a fascinating little detail hidden in the publisher's notes at the back of the book that I feel perfectly mirrors this tension between efficiency and humanity.
Oh, yes. The note on creation.
Yes. The publisher mentions that Moon actually used artificial intelligence to help organize her thoughts, refine her ideas, and bring a cohesive structure to the chaos of the manuscript.
And they compare the AI to a good kitchen timer.
It's the perfect analogy. Because the technology, whether it's the AI, the timers, the slow cookers, they provide the structure. They are the scaffolding. But the voice, the philosophy, the wandering mind, and most importantly, the spectacular kitchen disasters. Those are entirely irreducibly human.
It pushes back against this modern obsession we have with relentless productivity. We're so conditioned to feel that if we aren't perfectly, efficiently executing a task, we are failing.
Constantly.
But this book asks us to measure the value of the distraction itself. The technology keeps us on track, but the deviation from the track is where the actual living happens.
Wow. So as you go about your week, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over.
Mm-hmm.
The next time you mess up a completely mundane task, maybe you burn the toast or you miss your Subway stop or you put the milk in the pantry instead of the fridge because you were genuinely captivated by a conversation, a stray memory, or just something beautiful out the window, don't be so quick to scold yourself.
Give yourself some grace.
Exactly. Instead, ask yourself, what if the mistake was actually the main event and the task was just the distraction?